Well, good morning, everybody. And first of all, I'd like to say thank you very much for the invitation to the organisers and the sponsors. I already have the sense that this is a very good symposium. A lot of enthusiasm. So what I'm going to speak to you today is an overview on pesticide residues in food, how we look at it from an agricultural perspective, looking at the risk assessment and the end result for regulation. So a few principles to keep in mind right from the start, some ideas. First of all, consumers really don't want pesticide residues in their food. However, from the producer perspective, we need pesticides for economic production. So I like to think of it as a compromise, or here's the deal. Pesticide use is acceptable if residues are not harmful to human health, first principle, and no more pesticide is used than necessary to be effective, the ALARA principle, as low as reasonably achievable. So regulators need to keep those points in mind all the time. As well as being safe, there should be no more than necessary. So that's the background to how we look at the pesticide evaluation and regulation. Some questions we need to keep in mind to ourselves when we're evaluating pesticides. What is the nature of the residue? Is it the parent compound or is it something else? We need to look at the one that matters. How toxic is the pesticide and what are the toxic effects? The toxicologists can answer that. What happens to the residue during food processing? Does it change its nature? Is it different from when it started? And does it increase or decrease in level? And ultimately, what levels of residue occur in food? And always, what are the methods of analysis? So these are the questions that the regulator must ask all the time when working through a residue evaluation. So the things that I'll deal with in this presentation, national controls, how they work, well, a general picture of them, Codex and JMPR, then mainly from a JMPR perspective, the toxicological assessment, pesticide residues in food, diets or food consumption data, which we need for the risk assessment, then the dietary risk assessment, and then always keeping in mind some trade issues, because trade is one of the issues that crops up irrespective of food safety. First point, national controls. So what do we do in national controls on pesticide use? Well, we need to assess the four risks at registration. Occupational health, public health, which relates to residues in food from our perspective here, environment, risks to the environment, and the fourth one, risks to trade. We need to keep those in mind when we're doing national controls on pesticide use. Pesticide registration, so that each pesticide should be examined for its toxicity and its behaviour before it becomes registered at the national level. The registration ends up as the label directions for use, and we should have the idea in the user's minds that they must follow the label directions. And so many countries put control of use regulations in place which state that the users of pesticides must follow the label directions. And ultimately, at the end of the train, we might do some monitoring to find out how our systems are going. What residues do we end up in the food after we put all the controls in place? Now, one of the critical points right at the start is the proposed use and efficacy. So the label directions for how the pesticide is used should be derived from efficacy trials. And how the pesticide is used should be compatible with integrated pest management systems. So you shouldn't use pesticide in a way that destroys beneficial organisms. You should allow for resistance management, so some rotation of pesticide uses, sometimes when you're not using. And then the efficacy trial should give you the range of treatment rates, the various agricultural conditions to give the lowest effective rate for that pest crop combination. So we should find out how to best use the pesticide to control the pest without using any more than necessary. The ALARA principle comes in there. And then the results of those efficacy trials give us the details in the label directions for use, and that's the pest control, the rates of applications and timing, etc. And we should note right here that these label instructions ultimately determine the MRL. So the MRL should relate all the way back to the biological requirements to control the pest. So using no more than necessary, the MRL and the residues and the MRL should be no higher than necessary. The definition in FAO of good agricultural practice, and I think in many national governments also, good agricultural practice is the use of pesticides. And the use of pesticides includes the nationally authorised safe use of pesticides under actual conditions necessary for effective pest control. And then it goes on to explain that it includes all the uses up to their highest authorised use applied in a manner which leaves a residue which is the smallest amount practicable. So it includes the ALARA principle in that FAO definition. So we should keep that in mind when we're doing residue evaluations. National monitoring. There are different ways of doing the monitoring at the national level. So we should keep in mind the purpose that we're doing the monitoring. It could be control of use. So that's monitoring of residue levels in domestically produced food commodities to observe if pesticides are being used according to label directions. So if they're being used according to label directions, the residues should fall under the MRL. Consumer exposure, it's a different matter from the monitoring for MRL compliance. Consumer exposure, monitoring in total diet studies of residue levels in the food ready for consumption to provide data on actual exposure for comparison with pesticide acceptable daily intakes. So in this case, we would measure it on the edible portion or the food prepared for consumption, and we would then add up those intakes, take that into account with the dietary data and calculate the intake and compare with the acceptable daily intake. And then trade is another matter, monitoring of residue levels in imports and exports to check if the pesticide residue levels comply with the relevant standards, Codex MRLs or national MRLs. Whatever's your standards, then that's the trade monitoring. And many countries are doing trade monitoring. Now I should move on to Codex and JMPR. So we should understand that the international system is not like an international registration system. National systems are generally registration systems, but the international one is not just like a big national system. It's really a matter of setting standards, not registrations. The principles in Codex Alimentarius, aims to protect the health of consumers and ensure fair practices in the food trade. So it's got in there the two points that we really look to here, protect the health of consumers and we take into account the trade. One of the committees of Codex, the CCPR, the Codex Committee on Pesticide Residues, that's the one we're concerned with here, it's a committee of national representatives, so it has a political basis. It establishes maximum limits for pesticide residues in food commodities in trade, Those are our Codex MRLs. It receives scientific advice and recommendations from JMPR. And it's a well thought out system in setting aside the scientific advice from the political, trying to say, well, here's some advice from a scientific body. We don't need to debate very much about that. Let's focus on the other parts. Let's accept a lot of the scientific advice. So CCPR is the risk manager in this situation, and JMPR is the risk assessor. CCPR sits in, is one of the committees under the Worldwide General Subject Codex Committee Group. And JMPR is the scientific advisory body that reports its information and conclusions to CCPR. So that's where it fits into the Codex Alimentarius Commission. CCPR reports to the commission where the decisions of CCPR need to be ratified. So my what I'd like to speak to you about is the way that JMPR, the Joint Meeting on Pesticide Residues, operates. The JMPR has been in operation since the 1960s and I think has established a very good reputation for its scientific work and publications. JMPR operates by having members serve in their personal capacities, not as government representatives. So we can have people coming along there to work in JMPR on the scientific assessment, and they shouldn't really bring their national perspectives with them. Of course, they can bring their national experience with them, because if we get experience from many parts of the world, that's better than just from one place. Within the JMPR, it's a joint meeting. It's a joint meeting of WHO group and an FAO panel. The WHO group, the World Health Organization group, looks at the metabolism and toxicological data and estimates the ADIs, acceptable daily intakes, and the acute reference doses. So they're the tox indicators. The FAO panel reviews chemistry, environmental fate, metabolism, analytical methods, the use patterns, evaluates the residue trials, and estimates the maximum residue levels, and STMRs, supervised trials, median residues. The STMRs are used in dietary intake estimation. And both the WHO group and the FAO panel come together with back and forth discussion about the risk assessment, where the residue levels, the diet, and the toxicology are all enter into the risk assessment conclusions. So just coming back here, there's the evaluation process for national registration. And up on the left-hand side of the slide, we start with plant metabolism, farm animal metabolism, and that gives us the identity of the residue. We establish the pesticide use pattern necessary for pest control. So that means looking at the efficacy trials, which give us the instructions for the label. And then we have residue trials that are done according to those label instructions to tell us what sort of residues we will get if people follow the label instructions. On the other side of it, we look at the laboratory animal metabolism studies, the pesticide toxicology. The pesticide toxicology studies, and from those estimate the values for the ADI and acute reference dose. The two things are brought together here in the risk assessment. There's at the national level, we set the official MRL, and when all that's completed, we can register the use pattern on the official label. So that's the registration system from the pesticide residue perspective. The evaluation process in Codex is similar, but there are some important differences because it's not a registration system. First of all, up here, we accept the national registered users as GAP. So we don't look at, in JMPR, we don't look at efficacy trials and decide how it's to be used. We just except the national registered uses. They've already decided that. Apart from that, much of the rest of it is similar. The risk assessment, are the toxicology and dietary intake of residues compatible? The same type of decisions. But in the, at the end, estimate the maximum residue level and establish a Codex MRL. But there's no registration at the end of it. But generally, it's a similar process except up in this area here. I'll give you very briefly on the toxicological assessment because I don't know very much about that. That's for the toxicologists. So the things to look at in toxicological assessment, purity of the test material that's being examined, and we have to be careful that we don't extrapolate to a less pure material than what was actually tested on the animals. Metabolism in lab animals, what are the harmful effects in feeding trials, the dose response for lab animals, so what, how much effect there is according to different doses. There are multi-generation studies, developmental toxicity, neurotoxicity, mutagenicity studies, does it cause genetic damage, and a whole list of requirements, and we should always check, are there any data gaps? Are there any studies just not submitted or haven't been done? We always need to know that. From all those studies, we should be able to derive a no observable adverse effect level on the animals. And it is the highest dose with no effect on the most sensitive animal species tested. And it's measured in milligrams per kilogram of body weight per day. And the acceptable daily intake is derived from that no effect level. It's the daily intake which after a lifetime of exposure at that level is almost certain not to result in injury of any kind. And the ADI equals the no adverse effect level divided by a safety factor, or some more commonly nowadays called an uncertainty factor, usually 100, and its units are also milligrams per kilogram body weight per day. The factor of 100 usually comes from assuming that the most sensitive animal is going to be 10 times more sensitive than the average, and we also have a factor of 10 for extrapolating from laboratory animals to humans. So there's a 100-fold safety factor usually in there. The acute reference dose was introduced into the system about 10 years ago. The amount of substance in food and drinking water normally expressed on a body weight basis that can be ingested in a period of 24 hours or less without appreciable health risk to the consumer on the basis of all the known facts at the time of the evaluation. So the ADI is for the long-term effects and the acute reference dose is for the short-term effects. And the acute reference dose can on some occasions be equal to the ADI, but most times it's higher than the ADI because short-term exposure to most substances has less effect than a longer term. So in summary, the toxicological studies give us the ADI and the acute reference dose. And the idea for safety assessment is to ensure that consumers are not exposed to residue intakes that would exceed the acute reference dose in the short term or the ADI, acceptable daily intake, in the long term. That's our idea of where we're going. Now we move on to pesticide residues in food. And the things we look at here are metabolism, analytical methods, and we get residue definition from that. Good agricultural practice, I've already mentioned. Supervised residue trials. Food processing. And then the residues in the animal commodities that come through the feed, animal feed getting into the animals. So it's not a direct treatment. We usually have livestock metabolism. Usually it's a lactating goat and laying hen. We We want to know, where does the residue go in those animals and birds? In the tissues, which ones? In the milk and the eggs? The metabolite identity, is it the same as, do we get metabolites occurring? And what's the actual nature of the residues in the tissues, milk and eggs? Is it the parent compound or the parent compound plus some metabolites? And we pay special attention if it's fat soluble, because if it gets into the animal fat, it's liable to be a more persistent residue. And we should also note the nature of the residue when it's in the fat. Plant metabolism. What are the metabolites? And for plants, we also need to take account of photolysis products because it's exposed to the sunlight. We should pay special attention if there are plant metabolites that don't appear in the animal metabolism because they haven't been tested for toxicity. What is the composition of residue at normal harvest? How much of the parent compound is there? How much of the metabolites? Is it on the surface or is it absorbed into the crop? Does it absorb through leaves or roots? Does it translocate to seeds, fruits and other edible portion? We need to get an understanding of how that behaves in the plant. And there could be soil metabolites. Is it metabolised in the soil? And are the soil metabolites taken up by the crop and end up in edible portion? And then one that's come in the last 10 years, difference in metabolism in transgenic crops, because some of the transgenic crops purposely metabolise the herbicide differently because that's how they achieve their effects. Metabolism in soils and sediments, how long does it persist? So if it disappears from the soil quickly, maybe it's unlikely then to give you much residue in the final crop. We should take notice of any soil metabolites that don't match with plant metabolites. Root crops are especially exposed to soil residues or soil metabolites, and seed treatments also. Rice is a special case because it's grown in an anaerobic sediment, so that's a different situation from other crops, and maybe there's some new metabolites occur in that situation. And what happens to residues in following crops? Are the residues left from the previous treatment that get into the next crop? And that's a real nuisance for regulators, because the following crop may have no registered uses, but it can legitimately have residues. And how quickly does the whole thing disappear from the soil where it gets treated? And as I mentioned before, we always have to think of the analytical methods. For supervised trials and processing studies, we should include relevant metabolites in the method. We always should have validation data to make sure that the methods are working correctly. In JMPR, we normally say the analytical recovery should be between 70 and 130%. If it's outside that, the data become unusable generally. The limit of quantification, the lowest concentration where recovery are shown to be acceptable. And then for enforcement, analytical method, it should apply to the enforcement residue definition. And we prefer its inclusion in a multi-residue method, so it doesn't cost too much to do the enforcement. Freezer storage. How stable are the residues in the samples that go into the freezer? So there should be some tests done on that. They should represent the range of substrates, whether it's fatty material or starchy material or leafy, watery material. And we should discover conditions and intervals where decline is more than 30%. We would regard that as generally unacceptable. So people should then not store samples for longer than it's going to cause so much degradation. So now we come to the residue definition, which is the summary of the information we've got from all those metabolism and analytical methods and storage stability. An enforcement residue definition should be simple. We have to take into account cost of analysis, so just parent compound if possible, should fit into multi-residue methods. For regulators, we should be careful that the compound doesn't appear in more than one residue definition. If it appears in more than one, then there's a real problem for regulation. We try for international agreement, and we should express the residue as parent compound if possible. And fat solubility is determined. It decides how you should take the animal commodity samples. For dietary intake, we should include any transformation products if they contribute to the hazard. And the transformation products, metabolites, photolysis products, and chemical degradation products. So over here we have a different aim from the enforcement. And we should include the transformation products if from multiple sources and contributing to the hazard. So wherever it comes from, we should take it into account when we're doing the hazard assessment. Good agricultural practice. Well, JNPR accepts national registered uses as GAP, and the labels provide the details of use. That's fairly straightforward. Supervised residue trials. They should cover the range of conditions occurring in practice. We accept data from trials that match registered uses with allowance around application rate, pre-harvest interval, etc. So we have some tolerances on what can be accepted. We want an adequate number of trials, and normally we would expect 8 or 10 trials to be an adequate number. But we need to work with what we've got, because JNPR operates with what's submitted to national registration systems, so we need to work with what we've got. And from the trials, we obtain the maximum residue level, the STMR supervised trial median residue, and that's in the edible portion, and the high residue, that's also in the edible portion. Those two are used for risk assessment, and this one goes on to become the MRL for enforcement. So supervised trials median residue, median in the set of trials on edible portion, HR, highest residue in the set of trials in the edible portion, maximum residue level on commodity of trade estimated by JNPR, and maximum residue limit, JNPR recommends the maximum residue level to CCPR as suitable for establishing the MRL. So JNPR, as the risk assessor, estimates the maximum residue level. And that's a level that doesn't really have a sharp point in it. But once it becomes a codex limit, a maximum residue limit, that's like a legal limit that is then a sharp line. So that's our different terminology there to differentiate the scientific assessment from the legal limit. Now I come on to food processing. We want to know if the residue in the processed commodities is the same as in the raw commodity. So we see in studies that tell us what happens if we boil or bake or pasteurise commodities that have got residues. Does it change the residue? And the other part of it, we need to know the change in the residue levels from the raw agricultural commodity to the processed food commodity. And we end up with a processing factor, which is calculated from the residue level in processed commodity divided by residue level in raw commodity. In some cases, the residue levels increase, as you can easily imagine, if you dry fruit, and the residue is liable to increase because you're just taking water out. If you're processing something like wheat, and the residue is on the outside of the grain, then the residue in the flour will be lower than in the wheat, but the residue in the bran, the outside of the grain, is going to be higher than in the wheat. So in that case, you have a processing factor less than one for flour and a processing factor greater than one for the bran. Now, what happens when we feed the feed with residues to livestock? So we have livestock feeding trials where we find the levels of residue in the animal tissues, milk and eggs from repeated daily dosing. And dosing should reflect expected animal dietary burden of residues in the feed. And we also like to see rate of depletion when dosing ceases. If it's going to be any way persistent residue, it's nice to know how quickly it disappears. So that this is a feeding study, which is different from a metabolism study. Now we have to set the MRLs and STMRs in the animal commodities, and we integrate that information from the dietary burden on the animals, how much is actually expected in the animal feed, the feeding studies here. So this is like a calibration between residue and dose, or residue and the amount dosed. Put that into that calibration analysis of the data sets, and we end up with estimating maximum and median that might be in the animal commodities. We also can have residues in animal commodities from direct external animal treatment with ectoparasiticides. And this is pretty much like doing a residue trial on crops. Use the formulated product at the recommended dose rate, method of application and timing. Include the use likely to generate the highest residue. So there may be many uses, many different kinds of uses on the one animal. For example, on sheep, you could have an application just after shearing, when the wool's short, when the wool's long, could be a plunge dip, could be a spray dip, could be jetting, could be a pour on, and it could be a wound treatment. And we've got a registration that's got all those different uses on sheep. It seems very tedious to do trials on all those, so you should pick the ones that are liable to give the most residue and do the trials on that. Okay, now I'll move on to the diets, the other side of the dietary intake. We need to know something about diets. Diets or food consumption. For chronic intake, we need average diets, and in JMPR we use the diets derived from the food balance sheets, and they're available at that website on WHO. For short-term intake, we need large portion size, so it's no longer average, but people can eat 200 or 300 grams of some foods on a single sitting, so we need to take that into account. And we need also food unit weights, because people are eating individual apples. They don't eat an average apple. So we need to take into account individual unit weights, because they might have more residue on an individual than on the average. GEMS Food from WHO introduced the consumption cluster diets in 2006. They're based on those FAO food balance sheets that were data from 1997 to 2001. And I put a note in here, Cluster G includes China, India and Indonesia. And you can find those diets at that website. And that's the map of the current diets. You can see that's a pretty big one there. I guess it's best to go and have a look on the website to see where you sit on those. Remember in these diets that the consumptions for raw commodities include the consumption of the derived processed commodities. For example, consumption of grapes includes the consumption of wine. So we need to remember that when we're doing the dietary intake estimates. So in the dietary exposure calculation, when residue data are available for a processed commodity, the consumption of the processed commodity has to be subtracted from the raw commodity consumption. And we have notes in the spreadsheet that explain all that. So if you've got data on wine consumption, you can subtract 1.4 times the wine consumption from the grapes consumption when you're doing the estimates. And I have to compliment the people from the Netherlands who put all this stuff in a spreadsheet, and you can go in there and it's fairly simple to use, because it puts all those assumptions in the spreadsheet and you can work your way through it. Okay, the dietary risk assessment. So the idea here in the long term, dietary intake of residues equals the residue concentration by the food consumption. And the estimated daily intake for the pesticide is the sum of the intakes for all foods where that residue occurs. So you do it food by food, then add them up. And this is done in a spreadsheet. And divide the value by the body weight and compare with the ADI. So that tells you percent of ADI where you sit. If it's above 100% ADI, then generally it doesn't pass the register and you need to go back and have another look at your data and see if you've done everything correctly. Short term, we have high consumption of a food on one day and the high residue that might appear in that high consumption. And remember that the residue level in the first unit is V times as high as the high residue. So our default value in JNPR is 3. So the high apple might have 3 times as much residue as the average apple in that consignment. So that's the assumption that's made there. For risk assessment, we have those chronic, we have those 13 cluster diets. We sum those exposures for each food commodity, STMR by the food consumption compared with the ADI. For short term, each food separately, large portion by high residue by variable factor for some commodities, and compare with the acute reference dose. So in JNPR, we go through all those and they're transparently set out in the annexes to the JNPR reports. JNPR then recommends the estimated maximum residue levels as MRLs, maximum residue limits, only if the risk assessment passes both the chronic and short-term intake hurdles. So it needs to satisfy both those points, and then we can recommend them for use as MRLs. Now I come to the trade issues. And I think we're in the system now where we're grappling with the trade issues and MRLs. I guess we always have been, but I think we're getting further into that. Remembering that MRLs have been used or are used for 3 purposes. As reference points to decide if pesticides have been misused under control of use regulations, that's where they started. As trade standards, that's becoming more and more important. And as starting points for estimating consumer exposure, that was a very important use maybe 15 years or more ago, but that's becoming less and less important because we now start mainly from trial data. Control of use MRLs are parochial. That means that they suit a local situation, and they're far from ideal for international trade. So this is one of the problems that we have. When MRLs are used for control of use, with each country having its own pests, use patterns and use instructions, national MRLs are different from one country to another, as you would expect, because all those things are going to be different. Export food commodities, although meeting their own national MRLs, may not meet the importing country MRLs, leading to a trade dispute or incident. That is, the imports are not allowed to be sold. Because residues in food are presumed to be a consumer risk in each country until they have been fully evaluated and MRLs, or exemptions, established and the uses are registered. So that's what happens when we have each country setting its MRLs for control of use. And all those points are quite legitimate. Codex MRLs as trade standards is another matter. Codex MRLs were introduced to deal with this situation, and the SPS, that's the Sanitary and Phytosanitary Agreement, states that Codex standards and documents are taken to be the international consensus and can therefore be used as the presumptive levels in the event of a trade dispute. So my conclusion is there are many similarities in pesticide evaluation at the national and international level. International standards, the Codex standards, rely on data and information from their national registration systems. Codex standards aim to protect the health of consumers and to serve as globally uniform standards for international trade. Thank you very much.